Hello, listeners, and welcome back to a brand new episode of the Weird Era podcast. I am joined today by Miriam Lacroix to discuss her latest work, How It Works Out. Miriam Lacroix was born in Montreal to a Quebecois mother and a Moroccan father and currently lives in Vancouver. She has a BFA in creative writing from the University of British Columbia and an MFA from Syracuse University, where she was editor-in-chief of Salt Hill Journal and received the New York Public Humanities Fellowship for creating Out Front, an LGBTQ plus writing group whose goal was to expand the possibilities of queer writing. What if you had the chance to rewrite the course of your relationship again and again in the hopes that it would work out? When Miriam and Allison fall in love at a show in a rundown punk house, their relationship begins to unfold through a series of hypotheticals. What if they became mothers by finding a baby in an alley? What if the only cure for Miriam's depression was Allison's flesh? What if they were B-list celebrities, famous for writing a book about building healthy lesbian relationships? How much darker or sexier would their dynamic be if one were a power-hungry CEO and the other her lowly employee? From the fantasies of early romance to the slow encroaching of violence that unravels the fantasy, each reality builds to complete a brilliant, painfully funny portrait of love's many promises and perils. Equal parts sexy and profane, unsentimental and gut-wrenching, How It Works Out is a genre-bending, arresting, uncanny exploration of queerness, love, and our drive for connection in any and all possible worlds. Hi, Miriam. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Alex.
So I would love to start by hearing your thoughts on what makes How It Works Out an autobiographical text. I almost wrote here in the interview, you know, it's not every author who centers themselves in their own story, but I'd also categorically say that that's false. Of course, authors write themselves into their characters. So how much of Miriam Lacroix you hear is written in book, Miriam?
I mean, I'll start by saying that it is fiction. It's not an autobiographical text, but I did choose to use my name for the main character. And I think part of the reason for that was that it sort of forced me to be very vulnerable as I was So how that style developed was, I started writing like that when I was in my early 20s, and I like very naively didn't even know that autofiction was a thing, and I definitely thought I invented it myself, which is really embarrassing now. but I think it was during kind of the rise of Instagram and social media, and it just seemed like everyone was telling a story about themselves, and I didn't feel like I was really good at doing that. Yeah, in fact, I found it kind of embarrassing almost to talk about myself, and I felt really frustrated by that because I just felt like if you're going to make it in this world, you need to talk about yourself. You need to tell people who you are and what your story is, you know, whether it's in a cover letter for a job or on social media, or even if you're trying to make a friend and you meet them for the first time. And I felt just abysmally bad at that. And so I started writing these kind of satirical stories about myself that felt very overblown and I think I was trying to be rebellious or something. I'm gonna do this, but I don't like it, you know. And then in the end, I think the joke was on me, because I think that writing these like false stories about myself ended up being a very vulnerable thing. That made me turn toward myself in a way that I hadn't been able to, and made me question, like, you know, at the time I was thinking of those stories as lies, like I was making up lies about myself. Made me question, like, what is it that goes behind a lie? Why is it that people lie? And what are the lies that I'm telling about myself? And yeah, what's the vulnerability under that? So yeah, to answer your question again, I wouldn't say that it's autobiography. I think of it more as these kind of surreal self-portraits.
So in that case, then, in what ways, I mean, apart from the vulnerability aspect, has book Miriam, or we can, you know, call her fictional Miriam, inspired you in real life?
I mean, I think that book Miriam is not great. She's not a really fantastic person. I mean, I love her and I love writing her. She makes me laugh. And I think that that's healthy in a way. It's kind of a way of working through some of my own laughing at myself. I guess you could say that she inspires me to be better, because I think I really put all of my darkest sides and maybe biggest insecurities in really bold strokes down on the page. And obviously that's not who I want to be in real life, but it's a way of working through it.
In this collection, Love Bun in particular, I think, is a real standout story. There is just that kind of exists in reality, this language around love and attractiveness. And I think particularly, you know, when you're talking about how cute a child is, you could, quote, just eat them up. You're taking this statement then and making it literal. The question I have for you is, in what ways is love just hunger?
And so for Love Bun, I did really start with this idea of, like, the really, really deep, intense loves that, you know, have that sort of consuming quality, you know, consuming you and wanting to consume the other person. I don't think that that's necessarily a new idea, but I sort of took it a step further in terms of just thinking about the ways that consumption is maybe not healthy. Yeah, just the ways that, like, we can want to possess each other and hold on to each other as a way of maybe either protecting us in love, but in ways that, yeah, are actually quite harmful to other people in our lives, and that we end up calling love, even though it's not really love. It's, you know, it's a desire to possess completely.
So then, if we're taking that and in that, we're still staying in Love Bun right now, you then have this character Jonah, Miriam and Allison's son, who later goes on to eat one of his lovers. What can you tell us about intergenerational love, I think I would ask, and maybe how our parents are setting the first example of love for us? Do you believe that to be true? Do you think it's something inherent that we then are just going to translate even subconsciously into our adult relationships?
I mean, it's definitely a thread in the story that, that kind of, you know, attachment might be passed down. You know, in the story, Miriam is writing the cycle of abuse and intergenerational trauma, and she kind of can't pinpoint it in reality, And so the story in response gets quite surreal. Yeah, obviously I think that we, you know, we learn certain types of loves from our parents and from the way that they learned love from their parents. And, you know, who knows how far back that goes. And I think it's hard to learn new ways of loving. And sometimes, you know, we need to feel the pain of a bad love in order to learn how to love well. And I think that that's something that the Jonah character really has to experience in the worst way by eating his lover the way that he's seen, you know, his lesbian mothers eat each other his whole life.
For a book titled How It Works Out, nothing really works out for these characters. There are few instances where they end up with each other and fewer where they end up together and also happy. You can kind of feel the relationship eroding through the collection more and more. And the question I want to ask here is, why are we so desperate to imagine possible futures with people who we ultimately know are not good for us? And do you think this is a common thread among queer people specifically?
And I think there is something a little bit intoxicating about an impossible love. And maybe there is something quite queer about that, you know, the longing for something that you can't have. Yeah, I also think, you know, as queer people, we don't necessarily always have the best, well, not that we don't have good role models, we just don't have very many role models at all for how to love, and we don't have a lot of stories of how things do work out. And so I think it's easy to like experience queer love. It's something that for a lot of us has felt very forbidden and that we've really longed for, and to experience that and just dive right in without any sort of narrative for, you know, what a healthy love looks like, or what we actually do want out of our love stories. Yeah, I think it can be very confusing. It's a lot of work that we're doing for ourselves that we don't have like generations of knowledge passed down on how to navigate those things. You know, some of us have experienced shame around our desires growing up, and that I think that can be really hard to separate from our actual experience of love. Mm-hmm. I think growing up in a sort of homophobic environment made me feel at times like I was kind of bad. And I think in my relationships, it became kind of a pursuit, you know, to prove that I was good, to prove that I was good enough without wondering if the relationship was good for me.
You did say something in there that kind of, that I wanted to flip right back at you. What kind of love is nurturing to you?
I think the kind of love that gives me freedom. I'm in a really beautiful relationship right now. And so I think I've just learned so much since I wrote the last book, which was, you know, about a relationship that I had in my early 20s when I knew nothing about myself. I think that specifically, you know, love that is not consumptive, if consumptive is even a word, not metaphorically cannibalistic, but that allows you to be, you know, to be scared, to be uncertain, to go away sometimes and do your own thing and figure your own stuff out, and like know that the person is still going to be there and is still going to be accepting you the way you are, and you know, just the way you are in that moment.
So one of my questions in here was, are you in love right now? So you've answered that one. I'm curious, has your current partner read the book? What do they think about the book?
Yeah, I was definitely very nervous when I gave them an early copy. I was like holding my breath, like, are they still going to want to date me after they have read this? I mean, I think that's the sign of a truly great partner. My current partner just sees my dark, you know, opposite anyway. And I think, I don't know, I'm also lucky in that I'm dating someone who has similar taste in literature as me. They like weird, dark, funny fiction. And so they kind of laughed and thought it was great.
This book also, you know, jumping right off of that, it really fits in with the likes of Carmen Maria Machado and a lot of these other queer writers who are doing these incredible and experimental things with fiction and, you know, in Machado's case, with memoir as well. Do you think this is something inherent in contemporary queer writing? And by that, I mean, you know, is there just this desire to subvert what traditional literature looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I think we're at an interesting time right now where LGBTQ literature is more at the forefront than it has been in the past, and that I think that brought us in a weird kind of era where everyone was like, "Great, tell us your coming out story, you know, tell us what it's like to be queer," and that's basically the only thing that we're interested in hearing about you, which of course does not really, you know, represent a whole person. I think personally, and I know I'm not the only one to feel like this, I just wanted to write something that was just completely different from anything that people expected about me. I think I had this feeling that kind of, and you know, not that it isn't important to talk about all of our life experiences, and there's some beautiful stories about people coming out that are so essential, but I just tend to be a little contrary, and as soon as someone wants something from me, I just like don't want to do it at all. So yeah, I think I really, it's kind of surprising, actually, like the that I succeeded as an author, because I remember when I started writing this book, I remember some people being like, "Cool, yeah, like that's very edgy, like that, you know, it's probably not going to be a bestseller or anything, but keep it up, champ, you know, like do your thing if you must." I don't know. So, yeah, I think it took a lot of bravery, and I think a lot of people are being braver and just saying, you know, we have a million stories to write and a million ways that we can write them. And we're also, you know, we're queer. Of course, we're going to be weird. Of course, we're going to take risks. Yeah. For me, I think there's just something so satisfying about, I mean, if only formally, I think I really enjoy a formal literary challenge. I like to flex, you know, I like to be like, I can be queer and I can be innovative at the same time. I don't have to be the kind of queer that you want me to be. So. Yeah, and that's how other people feel too.
I definitely think, at least in Canadiana, you've written like the hot gay book of the summer, at least. How do you feel about it now that it is actually out in the world and you're going to be talking to more people about it? And maybe I would also ask, how do you feel it sits in canlit specifically?
The book comes out in a couple of weeks. And so I'm definitely, I too have noticed a certain amount of buzz, but I'm also trying to not get in my head about it. Or I've been trying to be like pretty detached from it. I don't think that it will help like my mental health or my writing if I'm overly attached to outcomes, you know. Even, yeah, I think it's strange trying to be detached from success, because success is what I obviously really wanted. That's why I worked so hard on my book for so long. But when you start to experience success, you realize like, oh, if I'm this attached to success, it means I'll be this attached to failure. And I don't think that I can afford to do that as an author. I have to really stay focused on, you know, doing what I believe in, so that, you know, and, you know, hopefully if I do what I've been, then I'll also have success. It's kind of a catch-22. So as far as how it sits in Canlit, I think that's something that I'm definitely figuring out. I am Canadian, and I'm French Canadian, so that kind of complicates the cultural question even a bit more. So I think as far as being Quebecois, I think that that does influence my style, because Quebecois people are so direct, and there's kind of this crude sense of humor that I realized was not the norm. Like when I moved to Western Canada, I was like, okay, my brand of directness and frankness is not like, yes, it's not what people are used to. And it got different reactions in the English world than it did in the French Canadian world, where we're like swearing and saying some obscenity every other sentence or whatever. But I think I still really identify with that way of being, the sort of no holds barred, I'm going to tell you my truth. And so I'm French Canadian. I had my writing education at UBC, and I think at UBC I definitely focused more on like learning craft. I studied with Annabelle Lyon and some other really great professors. At UBC is the time when I was starting to like get more seriously into fiction versus just like weird pages long prose poems that I wrote for no reason and no one. I think I got sort of a more like classical fiction education that was really important. And then I was really influenced, obviously, by going to Syracuse University in upstate New York, too, because I really, really wanted to study with George Saunders, who's a really big influence for me. Yeah, at the time, I think that little scene in Syracuse felt really special. And it felt really like where I wanted to be. There was just so much dark humor and so much talent and so much weirdness, but at the same time there was like there was skill and there was savvy. You know, the people that I studied with are like Anthony Vesnesseau, Nana Kwame, Ajay Brenya, you know, those types of people who were like, yeah, just incredible people to have around. And that felt incredible to my art too. And now I'm bringing it back to Canada, and I'm really curious how everyone's going to react. So far, so good.
The last story in this book is about a film adaptation of the earlier story we were discussing, Love Bun. Miriam and Allison really only exist as conceptual characters in this story. Not that they don't also exist as conceptual characters throughout this book, but in this one, you know, the characters are being portrayed by actors. I did want to ask you, what did like one more level of decentering those characters allow you to do as a writer?
Yeah, I think that was like that was a big swing, that last chapter. That was, I think at the time I was like, is it smart to like take such a sharp turn for the last chapter? But I think I really needed to. I think for me, the last chapter, it's both one of my favorite chapters in the book and was absolutely one of the most challenging to write. It deals more directly with trauma and self-perception in some ways. And to do that, I feel like I had to make more indirect. I had been putting myself on the line writing this Miriam character the whole time. But if I was going to write about more loaded things, I needed to put the weight of it on the shoulders of a fictional character. And I needed to, you know, I'm not a nonfiction writer. I'm probably never going to write about my own personal trauma because, you know, I'm busy dissecting that in therapy, and I doubt that I'll ever be done doing that. And it's, you know, I'll never have clear answers for anyone, I don't think. But it was really helpful for me to like, to create a fictional character who was trying to relate to the character of Miriam. So this actress, she is nicknamed Fetus Face because her face is kind of swollen and blank like a blister or a fetus or something, which makes her a really great actress because her face kind of takes the shape of whatever she's playing, but also poses some problems for her in her personal life. And so as she is playing this character of Miriam, who's the Miriam in the book, and trying to make sense of that character, it was a way for me to like really meta, like meta times three, try to make sense of the Miriam character in a more honest way than I had in the rest of the book, and without the layer of self-deprecation, because it went, one of the things that, you know, is great about writing a character with your name is that you can just make fun of them endlessly, and that's like so fun to write. But there comes a certain point where you need to have compassion for your character and like go deep, and that's even harder when it's a character that has your name. So I just needed to do it through a different character.
That's such an interesting answer to that. I'm also like quite fresh off of reading this, so it's all still kind of mulling around in my head. Miriam is not a villain in this book, particularly in the story, the sequel. You're writing from Allison's perspective, but you're not kind to Miriam or even very sympathetic, which follows through in a few of the other stories in there. I did just kind of want to ask, I know we've established that this is not an autobiographical book. The book Miriam is not particularly you. But how did writing Miriam affect you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was trying to not be too mean to the Miriam character. I had to... Yeah, I think there's a lot of stories in which...
You're pretty brutal at a couple parts.
I know. but I was holding back. I don't know, that, you know, there's like, there's the story, the sequel, which is another one that's from the Allison perspective that sort of villainizes the Miriam character. But I was, I don't know, maybe this that does say something about me, but the whole time I was kind of rooting for the Miriam character, you know, I was like, so what if she has like really intense mental health issues and is like hyper femme and addicted to her phone? Like, she's got a good heart, you know? I think it's easy to make a joke out of that. And I do think there's, to be honest, I felt sort of aware of the misogyny of like sort of making fun of like hyper femme characters. I didn't write that in a super prescriptive way. I left it a little bit up to interpretation, but I do hope that people will have compassion for the Miriam character, even when she shows up in really ugly ways. You know, in Anthropocene, perhaps the likable character in some ways. I mean, I do put the character through these like really terrible humiliations, may not be some sort of masochism, which is also relevant to that story. But yeah, I do think, you know, I was writing it from the perspective of Allison, who doesn't think very highly of Miriam, but I was hoping that people would see beyond that to the fact that, like, you know, maybe even though Miriam is like some evil CEO who's profiting from global warming, she does have a kid and she actually does have it pretty hard in the workplace, like being a woman in power. And she is like, maybe she's power mongering, but she also has a reason to want power. She's been very disempowered and she continues to be disempowered by her colleagues in the story and by Allison and by basically everyone that ever encounters her. And yeah, I think it's easy to laugh along with that, but I also think that that's why it was important for me to write the final story, in which there is this reflection on villainy and villainous women and the punishment of quote-unquote bad women and how women come to believe that they're bad.
If the multiverse does exist, would you take a peek, or do you think it's none of our business?
I mean, to be honest, I haven't done a lot of like scientific research on the multiverse. This is not like a thoroughly, you know, physics-based book experiment.
No.
I mean, I don't know. It's so dizzying. I think I would, because I think there's some... When I think of the multiverse and, you know, how my book is obviously being categorized as a multiverse, and they're kind of becoming increasingly popular, I think I understand why we're so obsessed with them, and I think it's because we're just at this very high stakes time in history. You know, I think politically and certainly the climate, it just feels like we have some really big choices to make and we have some really big changes to make. And it's a lot of it just feels very life or death. You know? I think I would be invested in being like, mm-hmm. What if we choose this path? Like, can we save the world then? You know, I don't think I would do it for my own relationships, because that seems unhealthy and not like the chill, healthy, detached kind of person trying to be now since writing that book. But for other things, I would definitely want to take a peek.
Interesting. Good answer, actually, I think. Listen, Miriam, again, thank you so much. I wish you all the success with this book. Like I was saying earlier, as a bookseller as well, I have a feeling it's going to be a real hot summer with Miriam Lacroix.
I hope so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for your time.